TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Kathy Kelly on Ending the Sanctions on Iraq. The noted writer, professor, and philosopher Edward Said said very recently that, quote, "For almost a full decade, an inhuman campaign of sanctions, the most complete ever in recorded history, has destroyed Iraq as a modern state, decimated its people, ruined its agriculture, education, and healthcare systems, as well as its entire infrastructure. All this has been done by the U.S. and the United Kingdom, misusing United Nations resolutions against innocent civilians, leaving the tyrant Saddam Hussein more or less untouched." End of quote by Edward Said. Kathy Kelly, the theologian and co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, has dedicated her life to telling the untold story, how these sanctions affect the children of Iraq. The numbers are truly horrifying. According to United Nations' own UNICEF figures, 5,000 children die each month for lack of proper medicine or nutrition. Kathy Kelly says that if the people of the U.S. and England were aware of these effects, there would be a huge effort to end these sanctions on Iraq. Since 1995, Kathy Kelly has traveled over a dozen times to Iraq to visit hospitals and clinics, to document the status of the children, and bring medicine and food. She often chooses to go to areas that are about to be attacked by U.S. and British warplanes, and has spent many nights in bomb shelters. Before her first journey to Iraq, she notified the State Department of her intent to break the sanctions. She received a letter threatening her with $1 million in fines and 12 years in federal prison for each time she entered Iraq. Kathy thanked the State Department for their clarity and announced the date of her first departure in 1996. She spoke in San Francisco at the Church of St. Anne's in the Sunset in May of 2000, after her most recent journey to Iraq. Father Labib Kopti, who gave her a heartfelt introduction, reminded the audience that Kathy Kelly had been part of the Gulf Peace Team, a civilian team that placed themselves at the beginning of the Gulf War between the U.S. and Iraqi army on the Saudi Arabian-Iraqi border. In 1995, when the effect of the sanctions on the children of Iraq became so painfully obvious, Kathy Kelly and her faith-based activist friends founded Voices in the Wilderness. Kathy Kelly begins by remembering that meeting around her kitchen table.
By 1995 in December, a member of an Illinois Pax Christi group, Chuck Quilty, drove to Chicago when a number of us were having a little reunion of sorts, and he said, "Look, all of you have talked at one time or another of doing something about these economic sanctions, and nothing happens. Either say you're not really going to do anything, or let's get started now." And there was something in the tone of his voice that commanded a recognition from all of us. And really, we sat around my kitchen table until we had put together the first document that we used to begin the Voices in the Wilderness campaign. And it was so easy when we drew upon what we do know of nonviolence. We rather easily thought of breaking the sanctions by bringing medicine, by bringing medical relief to Iraq in open and public defiance, but also as a means to then return to the United States and say, this is what we've seen and heard. Well, that occasioned many delegations which have gone back and forth to Iraq. But I have to say that even with these many trips, I still cannot wrap my mind around the reality of the statistics that continue to mount and augment the terrible death toll. I think it's become clear to me that the war never ended. It changed. And it changed into a kind of warfare far more lethal, far more brutal, far more destructive than even the worst of the bombardment during the Gulf War, or even the terror and the fright and the death imposed by the regular bombardments, which persist almost every second or third day now. And this is an economic warfare that is a discriminate form of warfare, discriminating directly against the very elderly. I think of my dad, and there are medicines that he has to have. And so do the elderly people in Iraq need certain medicines, certain assistance. I think of the sick, those who have diabetes, who have asthma, who have chronic diseases, who have cancer, and cannot get the meds that they need. I think of the poor who have no buffer and can quickly be reduced to beggary. And then, with a tragedy really beyond my own ken, the children. Over 500,000 children, under age 5, just the little ones, think of how they run, huh? Over 500,000 children have died as a direct result of economic sanctions, and this according to United Nations statistics. And in November of 1998, a report had come through from the World Health Organization estimating 4,000 to 5,000 children every month dying as a direct result of these economic sanctions. And yes, I've been in the hospital wards and seen the little ones who are gone, who have been felled by typhus, cholera, dysentery, diarrhea, colds that turn into pneumonia, endemic levels of a disease called leishmaniasis, cancers without medicines. This I have seen. But you know, when I try to imagine a metaphor that would help me connect with this number in the thousands, I wonder sometimes, must I perhaps think about a stadium? And what if the children were lined up single file? And what if they were marched into a stadium and their parents were kept outside? And what if they filled the bleachers and they sat in the blazing sun with empty bowls and they befouled themselves and cried out and their parents were ready to crawl over the stadium walls or even claw the cement because they were desperate to get to these children and protect them? And what if over a loudspeaker blaring in a British accent or an American accent, a voice were to say, you see these children whom you love, we're holding them hostage. And if you don't force your government to unconditionally surrender to every demand we make of it, we'll slaughter these children. And if you don't believe it, check your statistics from last month, or the month before, or the month before. Well, it doesn't match. It doesn't fit with who we know ourselves to be. We do not understand ourselves to be a society, a culture of child abusers. We don't believe in child sacrifice. And then I ask myself, why? Why is it that this is one of the best kept secrets in the United States today? And the answer that I would want to offer is that again and again, people in this country have reinforced into their heads through the media, and perhaps we would better speak of a military-industrial media congressional complex, that reinforced again and again is the notion that only one person lives in Iraq, their president, Saddam Hussein. Now, of course, this is patently ridiculous. It's a nation of 22 million people. But whom is it that you constantly hear about? And when the United States pounds and bombs, you get the impression that they're just trying to punish this one person. And so I think perhaps what I might offer in some of our time together would be some anecdotes about other people whom I've met in Iraq, trying to bring to life some of those voices that have so touched me and others amongst us who have been, I think, long wanting to more or less break back the wilderness in this country, a wilderness of compassion. So may I tell you about a situation that occurred for me when one of our teams was in a city, a small town called Fallujah, outside of Baghdad. This was February 1998, and we were in Fallujah with a British contingent of Voices in the Wilderness, mainly because we expected that there might be a rather huge bombardment of Iraq, another onslaught of the bombs, and we wanted to be able to say, look, the so-called smart bombs don't always hit their intended targets. And we wanted to be able to point out that in Fallujah, during the Gulf War, a bomb intended to hit a bridge had missed and had hit a crowded marketplace where 150 people were instantly killed. And we wanted to be able to give the people of Fallujah a chance to speak about their experience. And we had a film crew with us. Well, the people of Fallujah wanted to speak. It became a very noisy event. Well, then one man did speak English, and he approached me very directly, almost, you know, face to face, and he shouted at me, "You Americans, you Europeans, you come to my home, I'll show you water. You would not even give your animals to drink, and this is all what we have, and now you say you want to bomb us again. Well, you cannot take my child because you already have." My child, my son, was in that marketplace when the bomb exploded during the war. And then, looking at me almost as though with another set of eyes, he said to me, "Oh, madame, you are too tired. You come with me. I give you lunch." Takes my hand, leads me out of that crowd, and next thing I know, I'm at a falafel stand with him. This so typifies, again, my experience of Iraqi people. I would like to tell you another story. It is a story of hospitality, a little more difficult to tell. And that is one of having gone to a hospital, the Saddam City Teaching Hospital, Al-Mansur Children's Ward. And there, a very wonderful, fine doctor, Dr. Khusai Al-Rahim. He is a pediatrician who is so welcoming, so solicitous toward us, that we almost feel related to him. He has even said to us that he believes that we are all the fathers and mothers of these children together. Well, he was leading us through the hospital, apologizing that the elevator did not work, that there were not light bulbs overhead. These, of course, are results of the sanctions. Another result of the sanctions is that hospitals can't get the equipment for an intercom system. That would be way beyond expectations. And so when there's an emergency, people run to the end of the hallway and they scream for a doctor to help. And I think he must have a special radar now. He heard cries and he went running, and we caught up later. He was bent over the bedside of seven-month-old Furial. And really, this seven-month-old baby looked like a seven-month-old fetus. She'd had the terrible bad luck not only to have arrived at the malnourishment ward starving, but she also had a tiny infection. And you see, in the hospitals, they may have enough antibiotics to last for the 9 o'clock dose, the 12 o'clock dose, and the 5 o'clock dose of an antibiotic, but then not the 9 o'clock at night dose. Anyway, they could not give this baby sufficient antibiotics, and the infection went full body. She suffered from septicemia, from malnourishment, and finally, little Friel's heart gave out in a cardiac arrest as she tried to fight hunger and fight fever. And Dr. Khusai bent over her and did what he could to solve this terrible problem mouth to mouth. He resuscitated her. He brought her back to life. And Fariel's mother had a look of gleaming hope on her face. And then as Dr. Kasai stood up, she saw his eyes. Hope left her face. And he said, "I am sorry. Your child, she can be with you for minutes, maybe hours, but this child cannot live. We have not the oxygen. We have not the tube. We have not the mask." And he walked away. I felt a shattered man. The woman knew I was from the United States. We'd gone there the previous day. She pulled me down on the bed next to her, pulled me as though I were her sister into that sacred space that would be the last, in this case, maybe 20 minutes, between her and her beloved little Frial. And I remember my shoulder was damp from her tears, and she clung to me and she clung to the tube that they did have, and that tube was the size of a pencil. But little Frial's nostril was the size of the point of a pencil, so the tube was completely irrelevant. And there we sat as Frial gasped. And next to me, Martin Thomas, who had been with me in the Gulf Peace Team, a British person who'd gone back to England to study to be a nurse, looked at this scene, the inverse of everything you expect about hospitals and healthcare, and he murmured, "I think I understand. It's a death row for infants, isn't it?" And Martin had it right. A death row for infants. And together we murmured what we've said over and over again. "I'm sorry. I'm so very sorry." And walked away from that bedside. We walked into a hallway and a man was just hauling up the staircase his adolescent son. This child had, I believe it was diabetes, complicated by renal failure and then dehydration and dysentery. Very, very sick. The doctors were standing aside saying, "We have not what he needs." He was shouting, so we got out of the way and we walked into the cancer ward, a ward I'm very familiar with, and a doctor, again a hero, Dr. Salima Al-Haddad. I went to shake her hand, noticed that the ward had really only 3 beds filled. This was very unusual. It's quite crowded most often. And not thinking, clumsily, I said, "Oh, Dr. Al-Haddad, did all the children go home?" Well, could I say something more hurtful? She squared her shoulders, looked me in the eye, and she said, "Believe me, Miss Kathy, we did all what we could. And really now we are more social workers and psychiatrists than doctors because we have no medicines. And so first we helped all of the children on the ward get ready for the deaths of the other children who became their friends. And then we helped them get ready for their own deaths. And now you see there are just these 3 left." And standing next to her and smiling to fight back the tears, a young resident said, "We want you to know, Miss Kathy, we grow very close to these children as well over 6 months' time." I believe him. I also believe that if people in this country knew, if they knew that children, innocent little ones, bear the brunt of suffering because of these economic sanctions, if they knew it through visual representation, think about JonBenet Ramsey. Across this country, her story commanded indignation and a demand that this kind of thing must stop. If they knew, I think these sanctions wouldn't withstand the light of day. And let me discuss with you another contrast, which really points to another problem with our media within the military-industrial congressional media complex. And I'm going back to the onset of preparation for the Gulf War. And when I had learned that I could fly out with a contingent of U.S. people to this peace camp, I had a very, very quick schedule to follow. But the thing that I was procrastinating on that really made me lose courage almost completely was going home to tell my mother. And you can well imagine that she would want to dissuade me. So an hour into a conversation at my parents' home, I realized that I was getting no place trying to convince my mother that this was a good idea. And so in a kind of stalemate and feeling downhearted, I turned around to leave. And as I walked out the door, my mother shouted after me in her thick Irish brogue, "What about the incubators? Cathy, what about the incubators?" Well, now you might recall that before the United States declared its intent to go forward with the war, there was some debate and discussion. And then a young woman named Nayira, a very compelling Kuwaiti teenager, appeared before the U.S. Congress, and it was aired on many, many TV screens across the United States. Nayira testified that she had seen Iraqi soldiers pull the incubators out of the wall, dump the babies out of the incubators, and loot them, run off with the machines. Well, my mother was indignant, and of course this began many other questions. What are we to do about this marauding army? They've got to be stopped. Well, as it turned out, after the war fever and the hysteria died down, the story apparently wasn't true. When enterprising U.S. reporters went to the Kuwaiti hospital in question and asked the Kuwaiti doctors, "Could you tell us about that day when the Iraqi soldiers came in and stole your incubators?" the Kuwaiti doctors gave blank looks and said, "This is not the story we know." And it was difficult to find any evidence that Nayira had either left the United States or returned to the United States. In fact, she turned out to be the daughter of Kuwait's ambassador to the United States, and the Kuwaiti embassy had hired the Hill and Knowlton public relations firm, a very talented, competent firm, to coach the Kuwaiti government in making its appeals to the U.S. populace. And I thought to myself, why can't the mothers of Iraq give testimony before the U.S. Congress, as Nayira did? Please help educate your Congress people by taking vigorous actions, trying as much as we all can to approximate actions commensurate to the crimes being committed. Please join with Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Tell her you will no longer be accomplices to murder. Tell her that the price is not worth it, and help her understand that she still has an opportunity to separate herself from policies that have been murderous and abusive toward children. And if in that process somebody were to say, "Well, don't you think you're really supporting Iraq's president by these actions you're taking?" maybe you could just answer, "Hang on, don't mix me up with Arlen Specter and George Bush. They're the ones who helped to put the Ba'ath Party into power and arm and maintain Iraq's government through the Iran-Iraq war. I think these sanctions are in place because the United States wants to be able to maintain control over the region and over the region's wealth. I don't think the United States wants Saddam Hussein out of power. I think they want him where he is, crippled, but as a convenient excuse to maintain a troop presence in the region, to continue to have dominance and compliance on the part of, for instance, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, so that when the United States says raise the oil prices, they will raise them. When the U.S. says lower those oil prices, they will lower them, and so that the United States can continue to have a militarized, strong presence in an area where Iraq does not pose a threat to its neighbors." How can we say that Iraq poses a threat to Turkey? Turkey loaded up with arms from the United States and invading Iraq rather regularly to chase Kurdish people. Or that Iraq poses a threat to Saudi Arabia with 30 U.S. military bases. Is Iraq a threat to Egypt, a number one recipient of U.S. aid, is Iraq a threat to Israel with 200 to 600 thermonuclear weapons? Iraq doesn't pose a threat to its neighbors. Iraq poses a threat to the U.S. ability to control Iraq's natural resources. The United States often wants to believe that it's in our national interest to tell other countries that if they don't subordinate themselves to serving our national interest, we could eliminate them. But I don't believe this is in our national interest. I would far rather bet on what Pax Christi puts forth as being our national interest, a belief in simplicity, a belief that if we learn to live with less, we could live more happily. We don't need to have 2 and 3 cars per family. We don't need to guzzle so much of the world's resources. It's a pity if our national religion becomes shopping. We could live in another way. Pax Christi believes in service, serious service of the needs and the cares and the concerns of our neighbors, and in reverence for all of being. And then in advocating nonviolent resistance to injustices, and this I believe we can advocate on the part of our government's responses to crises and wrongdoing elsewhere in the world. This, I think, would offer all of us much greater national security.
That was Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, a nonviolent organization in the spirit of Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi, dedicated to removing the sanctions on Iraq. The American Friends Service Committee has nominated her for the 2000 Nobel Peace Prize. She is speaking all around the U.S. and internationally, and has written many articles and a chapter in a new book by South End Press, Iraq Under Siege. You can find more information on the website of Voices in the Wilderness at www.nonviolence.org/VITW. Don't miss next week's talk by Rania Masri, the coordinator of the Iraqi Action Coalition. You can get a one-hour copy of Kathy Kelly's talk, including Rania Masri, for $12. Call our toll-free number at 877-TUC-TAPE for a credit card order. That's 877-TUC-TAPE. Or send us a check to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's $12 to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. For more information on this and other programs, with links to important websites, go to TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Kathy Kelly's talk at St. Anne's was recorded by Jeffrey Blankford. The music is by Gia Sauchdev. My name is Mariah Gallarden. Thank you for listening.